It is Monday, April the 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up, the North Korean missile test and China's reluctance to step in.
You know, it's a partial success. They actually got a missile to leave the submarine and ignite for once. They've claimed they've done it before, but most of the indications were that those were failures. So it partially worked, which is kind of the typical with the new missile program. They don't work perfectly when you start, and you have to resolve little problems that eventually lead to hopefully a successful program.
Also ahead, trade across the Atlantic, anniversaries, Chernobyl nuclear accident, and the Nepal quake, plus choosing a U.S. president. Hello, everyone. The United Nations Security Council has condemned North Korea for its submarine-launched ballistic missile test Saturday, calling it another serious violation of existing U.N. resolutions. Pyongyang said the test was successful. South Korea claims it was a failure. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Korea analyst Bruce Bennett at RAND Corporation for his thoughts.
You know, it's a partial success. They actually got a missile to leave the submarine and ignite for once. They've claimed they've done it before, but most of the indications were that those were failures. So it partially worked, which is kind of the typical with the new missile program. They don't work perfectly when you start, and you have to resolve little problems that eventually lead to hopefully a successful program. So far, they're partway into the program, more normal for a developing missile system.
Do you detect an uptick in the pace of such testing in North Korea?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, now this is at least their fourth and perhaps their fifth test, according to what's been said in the media today, all in less than a year. That's really pretty progressive for the North Koreans. They're clearly trying to make some points before their May Party Congress that's only a few weeks out.
Well, a top senior U.S. military official told Congress just last week that he's very alarmed that North Korea could achieve its goals of reaching all of its quote-unquote enemies with nuclear weapons not too far down the road.
Certainly that they're moving in that direction. They've still got some major problems to resolve. And this missile, while it's fairly long range, the submarine would have to be sitting way out in the Pacific in order to reach the U.S. So it's more a broader regional threat that it opposes, that it apparently poses to South Korea, to Japan, but notably also to China.
What does the U.N. Security Council statement tell you in terms of possible further sanctions?
Well, so far, what they've said is that it was a bad thing. Now the real question is, are they going to be prepared to do anything about it? There's also just today the report that Chinese trade with North Korea was up like 15% last month compared to a year ago. So at least as of last month, it doesn't look like the sanctions approved in early March had much bite. Now they appear to be biting in, especially on iron and on the metals. And probably in other places. But China was reluctant to put much control on coal exports from North Korea or on other things. The key things at this stage are strengthening some of the sanctions already, and in particular, oil. Not letting oil get into North Korea, that would be really serious. But China has put some real limits on that in the last resolution.
Speaking Sunday in Germany, President Obama said, "We have cultivated cooperation with the Chinese to put pressure on North Korea, although it is not where we would completely like it to be," unquote.
Well, sure. The Chinese are still very concerned about instability in North Korea. That's why they refused to take action right after the fourth nuclear test. They are anxious to avoid a sudden North Korean collapse, and with the Party Congress coming up in just a couple weeks, it's going to be difficult. But I think the real key is the United States and China ought to be talking about what it is we will do with North Korea if they do a fifth nuclear test, which would be a blatant violation and which really ought to have some serious sanctions. Because unless we talk about it beforehand, we're unlikely to deter North Korea from making such a test.
On Saturday, the North Korean Foreign Minister, Ri Soo-yong, said that his country is prepared to halt its nuclear testing if the U.S. suspends its annual military exercises with South Korea. President Obama Sunday in Germany saying Washington is not taking the proposal seriously and Pyongyang would, quote, have to do better than that, unquote.
sure. I mean, North Korea wants us to halt our conventional training when it doesn't halt its own conventional training. It never says that it's been doing very heavy training over the last 3 months. So North Korea needs to be more balanced in their perspective. They want us to stop training. They need to stop their own. But I think it would be a broader kind of agreement of any kind that would be held, including not only stopping nuclear tests, but stopping all these missile tests. So North Korea's got a lot of things that they're violating Security Council resolutions on that they need to be more serious and honest about.
That is Korea analyst Bruce Bennett at the RAND Corporation. He was speaking with my colleague, Victor Beatty. Now we have our social media expert, G. Abby Lee, for what's being said online about the North Korea missile test. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve.
Well, is President Obama tweeting about it?
No, not President Obama, not the White House, nor Secretary of State John Kerry. But Canadian Foreign Minister did. Stéphane Dion tweeted, "Canada calls on North Korea to cease its reckless provocations and refrain from actions which pose a threat to international peace and security." Many well-known media outlets are tweeting about it. This is what China's Xinhua News Agency wrote. What does North Korea vow to do should the U.S. and South Korea stage nuclear provocations against it? The Xinhua article highlighted a North Korean official's claim to launch preemptive strikes if the two countries continue their annual joint exercises in the East Sea. A TV network in Iran, a country which also has a nuclear program, tweeted about it. Press TV wrote, "North Korea missile launches getting serious, U.S. official says."
Interesting. I see. What about here in the U.S.?
Here it's more about President Obama's remarks. Bloomberg Politics tweeted, "Obama says U.S. won't stop military drills spurning North Korea." And here is a Facebook post by NBC News. "President Obama said Sunday he doesn't take seriously North Korea's claim that it would halt nuclear tests if the U.S. suspends military exercises with South Korea."
And I just have to know the public reaction, like, to Mr. Obama's position.
Yeah, one of the most popular replies reads, "President Obama is far from perfect, but at least he's professional and classy." Mm-hmm. Other people criticized the commander-in-chief didn't take ISIS seriously either, and that took a toll on America's national security.
Yeah, I see.
Steve, as you know, President Obama is in Germany, and during his talks with his German counterpart, he mentioned North Korea's nuclear programs, which many Korean media outlets also tweeted about Sunday. Back to you.
And many thanks to you, G. That is VOA's social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. You can also follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA_IE. Coming up, just as G mentioned, President Obama is in Germany. We'll have more. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. In Hanover, Germany, President Obama, alongside Chancellor Angela Merkel, said the United States and the European Union must move forward on a landmark free trade agreement despite strong opposition to that accord. U.S. and Germany are among each other's largest trade partners and hope to build support for the so-called Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. We asked Gary Huffbauer, an expert in international trade at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, if the opposition to the trade deal could torpedo it.
I don't think they will torpedo
The continued negotiation by the experts, the ministers on both sides. But when it comes to approval, ratification by the European Parliament and by the U.S. Congress, that's where the protesters have their biggest chance to torpedo the deal.
And we also asked him why that might be the case.
Well, they will probably get some parliamentarians who agree with them and find glitches in the PACs. They'll argue that it's entirely for corporate interests and so forth. And there'll be probably some arguments about GMOs, possibly some phytosanitary issues and so forth on both sides of the Atlantic. So what we found in the past is that these protest movements are strongest when parliaments and congresses are considering the agreements. So we're a long way away from that, but at that point, the protesters will have their day.
Opponents have been critical of what they perceive as opaque negotiations carried out away from the public scrutiny, and they fear the PAC will hand too much power to big multinationals at the expense of the consumers and the workers. Officials have estimated that the U.S.-Europe deal would add $100 billion annually to the economies on both sides of the Atlantic. While in Germany, President Obama and Chancellor Merkel also discussed a number of issues such as terrorism, transatlantic security, and the global economy. Before heading to Germany, Mr. Obama was in London for meetings with Prime Minister David Cameron, opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn, and to have lunch with Queen Elizabeth, who was celebrating her 90th birthday. President Obama also took part in a London town hall meeting with young people, whom he challenged to reject ideologies that isolate and divide them from others.
The forces that lead to the most violence and the most injustice typically spring out of people saying, I want to feel important by dividing the world into us and them.
President Obama will cap his visit to Germany later today with a speech outlining his vision for future U.S.-European relations. Tomorrow marks the 30th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster, when a reactor at a nuclear power plant in the then Soviet-controlled Ukraine exploded, releasing huge amounts of radiation. 116,000 people living around that plant were evacuated. A further 220,000 were forced to leave. Subsequent years, as the so-called death zone of contamination was expanded. Henry Ridgewell reports now from Chernobyl on the emotional heartbreak still felt 3 decades later and the eerie ghost towns left behind.
The bond with a childhood home, the memories of a painful escape. Alexander Gruzevich lived with his parents at No. 6 Leningradskaya in the town of Chernobyl.
When I was a little boy, my mother made a large fire in the hearth. In winter, when it was frosty, the hearth was well warmed.
Years later, in the early hours of April 26, 1986, Gruzevich went outside to smoke a cigarette.
I saw something like a glow, something like a sunset. It had such a blood red color. I thought to myself, what a very strange time for such a glow. What sun could be here at this time? The next day, however, we weren't told a thing.
16 kilometers away, the scale of the disaster unfolding at the nuclear power station was becoming clear. The order to evacuate Chernobyl came 10 days later. Directly downwind, the town of Pripyat housed the workers from the power station. Many watched the fire take hold from the balconies of their apartments. The town is now a disturbing monument to the world's worst nuclear accident. As the buildings slowly crumble, radioactive birch trees are reclaiming the land. In the local school, child-sized gas masks, precautions from the paranoia of the Cold War, litter a classroom floor. Textbooks praise the achievements of the Soviet Union. Amid the desolation, there are startling signs of life. A few hundred mostly elderly evacuees have resettled in the exclusion zone and are quietly tolerated by authorities. Many cultivate their own food, despite warnings that contamination rises rapidly just below the surface. Chernobyl town still houses around 3,000 people who continue to work on decommissioning the plant. They can only stay inside the zone for 14 days. Once a week, Alexander Gruzevich travels from Kiev to work in a hospital in Chernobyl, just a few minutes' walk from his old home.
My mother used to say to my father, "Let's come back, let's come back." But they did not manage to do it. However, about a month after the accident, my father and I came to our old house. It was destroyed. The windows were broken, the doors were open. All our things were stolen. Nothing was left.
Scientists say the exclusion zone won't be safely habitable for another 20,000 years. But for some evacuees, Chernobyl remains home, and the urge to return outweighs the invisible dangers that lurk all around. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Chernobyl, Ukraine.
In Nepal on Sunday, thousands of people marked the one-year anniversary of a devastating earthquake. Quake, that is, they grieve for the loss of nearly 9,000 people in the midst of lagging reconstruction that's left 4 million survivors in temporary shelters. In Kathmandu, many went into the square. They lit thousands of candles and remembered those who were lost in the quake. Sugarika was one of the mourners. She said her people have faced a very difficult situation, but they are happy, she says, and lucky today because they are alive. But many others aren't very happy. About 100 protesters clashed with riot police outside the prime minister's office, demonstrating against the slow pace of the Nepalese recovery. More than 600,000 homes were destroyed in the magnitude 7.8 quake that upended roads in the country and turned mountain villages into rubble. Next major test of the U.S. presidential campaign comes tomorrow when five northeastern states holding primaries. They are Connecticut, Delaware, Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. The two presidential frontrunners, Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton, appear well positioned to pick up more delegates, solidifying their status as the top contenders. We get more now from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Donald Trump is riding high after his big win in New York. Trump is now asking supporters to look ahead and imagine him winning the White House in November.
When I cast that vote for Donald Trump to be president of the United States, and when he won shortly thereafter, our country became great again. We started to win again. And believe me, we're going to win, win, win. Remember, make America great again.
Trump hopes to deal his rivals another blow on Tuesday in five northeastern states where polls show him leading. But Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich continue to battle for delegates in the hope of denying Trump a first ballot victory at the National Nominating Convention in Cleveland in July. And Cruz insists he would emerge victorious at a contested Republican convention.
65-70% of Republicans recognize that Donald Trump is not the best candidate to go head-to-head with Hillary Clinton.
Trump remains the favorite to be the Republican nominee, but must continue to win most of the remaining delegates to avoid a battle at the convention, says analyst John Fortier.
There's some states coming up that are also favorable to him, but he's still not guaranteed the nomination. No one else can get it outright. Ted Cruz cannot get to the mathematical number. John Kasich cannot. But Donald Trump might be the clear nominee, or he might fall short, and we'd have to decide that at a convention.
Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton is also coming off a victory in her home state of New York over rival Bernie Sanders. Clinton is emphasizing party and national unity as she looks to wrap up the Democratic nomination.
In a democracy, we don't think anybody does have all the truth. You know, we're not a dictatorship. We're not an authoritarian regime. We're not a theocracy. We're a democracy, and we got to talk and listen again.
Despite the drubbing in New York, Sanders has vowed to fight on, even as some Democrats urge him to temper his attacks on Clinton and work toward party unity. Sanders remains focused on building a political revolution.
We were considered to be a fringe candidacy. That's right. We have come a long way in the last 11 months.
Clinton is favored in the five northeastern states voting on Tuesday, and Clinton victories could put even more pressure on Sanders to consider how much longer he wants to continue his fight. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
And you can stay on top of the U.S. presidential race at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Treating someone infected with viruses such as HIV, Ebola, influenza, and Zika has always been a challenge. Viruses are known to quickly mutate and develop a resistance to drugs designed to eliminate them. Scientists looking to create antiviral medications usually go after these nasty bugs one at a time. But some are expanding their focus to develop drugs that will fight more than one type of virus at once. Unfortunately, some of the new methods used to fight multiple viruses may also be poisonous to healthy cells. A team of Asian and American scientists say they've come up with a plan that fights a wide range of viruses, even those that mutate to develop resistance. This new approach uses a polymer called polyethylenamine that is specially treated to make it non-toxic. This polymer electrostatically interacts with both viral and human cells to prevent infection. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Fans are continuing to celebrate the life of American singer-songwriter Prince. His publicist says the musician was cremated and the whereabouts of his remains are being kept private. Friends and family gathered for a small memorial service on Saturday at Prince's estate. Musician Larry Graham was there.
I appreciate the support and the love and all the hugs. I appreciate that. And I know that Sheila feels the same way that I feel, that Prince made us all a better musician. Spiritually is the most important thing. He was a very spiritual man. But as a musician, he pushed us. He made us better. And so we miss him deeply.
Indeed, he was talking about Sheila Escovedo, the percussionist and singer. Medical examiners are still looking into what killed the 57-year-old musician Prince, who was found dead alone at his home on Thursday. Police say there are no signs of trauma on his body and no reason to suspect suicide. And tributes for the artist have poured in from all over the world. And later today, Prince fans in the U.S. city of New Orleans are holding a jazz funeral for the legendary musician in the historic Treme neighborhood. Organized over Facebook, it will include mourners clad in purple, in reference to Purple Rain, his big movie and song, traditional marching bands, and a release of White Doves. The 15th annual Tribeca Film Festival concluded Sunday with stars like Viola Davis, Danny DeVito, and Jane Fonda being a part of the events in New York. Four-time Oscar nominee Ethan Hawke premiered his new movie, The Phenom, at the festival. The movie is a sports drama about a talented young baseball pitcher who is sent to a sports psychologist, and memories he has abused as a child come to light.
I was knocked out by the script, and the second I read it, I wanted to be in it. And so I'm happy that we're finally getting to show it to people. This will be a movie that, you know, you never know how movies go over when they first come out. But I have a lot of confidence that this will be a movie that, over time, will find its fans.
Danny DeVito directed the short film Curmudgeons, which held its world premiere in the shorts narrative section of the festival. He also stars in the movie alongside his daughter Lucy, who is a producer, along with his son Jake.
This is concentrated fun. We shot it in 3 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and we, you know, everybody jumped in.
Viola Davis's movie Custody held its world premiere at Tribeca. She plays a New York judge in the middle of a child custody case. The movie filmed in New York.
You can't recreate New York. It's another character in and of itself. It's another beast in and of itself, you know? And so it became, literally became another character to be either defeated or embraced.
And TV is also a big draw at Tribeca. Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin attended events to promote the second season of their Netflix comedy, Grace and Frankie. Tom Hiddleston walked the carpet ahead of a panel and screening of his new TV series, The Night Manager. And Juliana Margulies and other Good Wife co-stars attended a farewell event for their long-running CBS drama. And a little sports news. At the London Marathon on Sunday, the men's race was all about speed, and the women provided the drama. For the men, Eliud Kipchoge rushed to a course record and a feat of fortitude for Jemima Sumgong, recovering from a painful fall to win. London Marathon on Sunday produced contrasting victories in the men's and women's races for the 31-year-old Kenyans. It was a chilly and a windy day, a difficult one for many. It was the first major marathon title for Sumgong, who had previously been a runner-up in Boston, Chicago, and New York. And British astronaut Tim Peake ran the race harnessed to a treadmill aboard the International Space Station, with a simulation of the route through London streets playing on his iPad. 44-year-old Peake finished in 3 hours, 35 minutes, 20 minutes slower than what a British helicopter pilot had done back in 1999. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Cornelius Tenner, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Stealing a person's idea, invention, or creative expression is no less of a crime than is stealing another person's car or breaking into their home and making off with their valuables. But the fact is that depriving people of profit from the fruits of their own imagination, what's known as intellectual property, is detrimental to everyone. Intellectual property refers to unique creations of the human mind that are subsequently recognized and protected by law, such as inventions, literary and artistic works, as well as symbols, names, images, and designs used in commerce. It includes musical performances, films, fashion, advances in technology or medicine, and innovations on existing design in every field and genre. Some consequences of intellectual property theft are obvious. Every time a customer purchases pirated film or a counterfeit item made to look like an expensive name brand, the brand's owners receive no compensation for their labors, and the customer is cheated because the value of the purchase is less than advertised. Worse, if a patient is treated with counterfeit medication, their health could suffer or they could die. Intellectual property theft deprives artists, inventors, and innovators of their just compensation, government of tax revenue, and it slows economic growth and stifles creativity and innovation. On April 26th, we observe World Intellectual Property Day, not just to celebrate the creativity of the human mind and the contributions made to the development of a society by innovators and creators, but also to draw attention to the necessity of protecting intellectual property everywhere around the world. The protection and enforcement of intellectual property rights help ensure the world will continue to benefit from the time, resources, and brain power invested in developing new technologies and improvement of existing ones, from the works of some of our most creative citizens, and from new brands and modes of production. This, in turn, fosters economic growth and attracts investment that will create new jobs and opportunities for all citizens. On this day, as we celebrate the human capacity to create, innovate, and invent, we call on all our friends and partners to stiffen intellectual property laws where needed and enforce them strictly for the sake of us all.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
for, what's